Here's a remark from the psychologist Henry Murray about Satan's standing in our own time. Satan, he writes, is no more than a vestigial image, a broken-spirited relic of a perished past, a ludicrous ham actor with no greater part to play in man's imagination than the vermiform appendix in his gut. Satan, always receding and always sought after, has had two very different meanings in our history. Sometimes he's been used for the purpose of construing the other as a monster, and sometimes he's been a symbol of our own deficient love, our potential for envy and rancor toward creation. Since the experience of evil will not go away, one or the other of these ways of coping with it sooner or later always comes back.
Commentator Andrew Del Banco. He's here to talk about his new book, The Death of Satan, How Americans Have Lost the Sense of Evil. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. There was a time when Americans had clear beliefs about God and Satan. There was a time when Americans were known to be obsessed with sin, picturing their history as an epic struggle with evil. But today, according to literary scholar and social commentator Andrew Del Banco, we face a paradox. The repertoire of evil has never been richer. We face daily images of once unimaginable horrors such as murder, child abuse, the cruelty of war, and mass death. Yet our grasp on the reality of evil is weak and our responses to it flustered. This crisis of incompetence is the subject of Andrew Del Banco's new book, The Death of Satan, How Americans Have Lost the Sense of Evil. Andrew Del Banco is a professor of English and American Literature at Columbia University. Andy Del Banco, welcome back to Soundings. Congratulations on the publication of your new book.
Thank you, Wayne. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Tell me what happened to Satan. Who killed Satan?
Well, I guess we killed him, though there's some signs he may be coming back. Something like a vampire from the dead. Seems to me that we've got a division in our culture today. We have some people, a great many people, who still take Satan seriously, who attribute to him the horrors and sufferings of their lives. But we have a great many more people whom I would identify as members of the liberal secular culture who regard Satan as a joke.
Mm-hmm.
That passage from Henry Murray, it's as if Dr. Murray, who died some years ago, had gone to see Jerry Lewis playing the devil in the recent revival of Damn Yankees. For these people, Satan is a defunct image, a symbol from a time of superstition, a crude way of trying to identify those forces that we feel arrayed against ourselves as we try to make ourselves get through this life.
Now, Andy, we see around us in our modern American mass culture the signs of Satan, the signs of evil. We look about, we see awful things like the Challenger explosion, the explosion in Oklahoma City, young women who apparently are murdering their own children, and we say, how should we understand this? How can we talk to ourselves about this? Part of what you're writing about in your book is a lack of vocabulary to come to this problem.
Exactly. See, what drove me to work on this book, I think, Wayne, is my sense of how language is failing us in the face of these kinds of experiences. I think back to the Challenger explosion that you mentioned. I watched it on television like millions of other Americans. I didn't see it live. I saw one of the many replays that filled the screens that day. And I remember watching the anchorman on one of the major networks, who thought, of course, he was there to report this triumph of technology and this human interest story.
Mm-hmm.
And instead found himself having to comment on what had just happened, this horrific event in which this spacecraft turned into white vapor before our eyes.
And what did he say?
Well, for a long time, he didn't say anything, and it was as if he was embarrassed as those expensive television seconds ticked by. Finally, he found something to say. He looked at the panel of experts that had been hastily assembled to join him there at the anchor desk, and he said, "Does this mean that the Russians are ahead?"
Now, you say that here what he's reaching for is a sort of symbol or vocabulary for Satan. That is to say, Ronald Reagan's formulation of the Russians as the evil empire.
Exactly. Reagan had tapped into a deep appetite in the American psyche when he identified the Russians as the evil empire. The trouble was that sort of quasi-metaphysical language of the Cold War was already out of date by the time Reagan used it, and certainly by the time that this anchorman tried to bring it back back to life.
Andy, I want you to give us a quick sense of the range of definitions that you write about in your book, The Death of Satan, with which Americans as a culture come to terms, try to come to terms with the concept of evil.
Well, Wayne, at bottom, I think my argument is that the devil, who has, of course, been a crucially important symbol, not just in this country, but throughout Western culture, has had two very different kinds of meaning, meanings that are, I think, largely incompatible. On the one hand, he's been used as an image of that threatening other, that alien, that dangerous outsider, that heretic. On the other hand, he has been used as a way to symbolize the devil within. That is, our own deficiency, our own weakness. The devil, one wants to remember, in the biblical narrative and in the many stories that were spun out of that narrative, is a symbol, after all, of the overweening self, this figure who can't come to terms with the fact that he's not omnipotent and that he's not omniscient. And that notion of the self as at war with its own deficiencies is a complex and subtle idea. On the other hand, the devil as a symbol of the enemy, that fell and mighty, nasty outsider who has no business in your community, is a rather simple and psychically rewarding idea. The two are very different.
I want you to move us backward in time, Andy Del Banco, to the world of the American Puritans. And here in your book, The Death of Satan, you outline in broad strokes how this division was a very live idea in the minds of these American people, these citizens, what shall we call them, 300 years ago. And then it began to get complicated. How about this?
Well, I think the struggle for the Puritans, for this culture in the 17th century, was to try to hold on to that complex understanding of the nature of evil, to try to understand this symbol as a representation of what they called original sin, this impulse to transgress against the obligations defined for us all by God.
And now, this is part of what brought them to the New World, the separating themselves and trying to set up this beautiful, perfect city on the hill.
It was indeed. And they looked back to Augustine, to St. Augustine, as their great theological master. And they believed, I think, very deeply in his privative conception of evil.
Now, wait, let's pause on this word, because this is a very important term that you're using. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that, or what I take Augustine to have meant by it, is that evil can best be understood, indeed can only be understood, as privation, as the absence of the good, as cold, as the absence of heat. That is, evil is the failure to see the beatific vision, the beauty of divinity, the obligations to which God holds every man up. And evil is that sinking into the self, that sort of nearsightedness that leads us to construe the world as organized around ourselves, that our feelings and our aspirations and our ambitions are at the center of the narrative, and it's that that matters.
Well, now, if we move forward 50, 75, 100 years in American culture, Andy Del Banco, we come to a time where the self is all important, where this sense of pride, the word individualism comes to mind.
Exactly. This, I think, is the great problem for the devil in American history. Here is this symbol, right, which, if you think, say, of Paradise Lost, is all about pride. I mean, the devil is, he sort of embodied pride. He's this, he's a creature of self-love, and that leads very quickly into hatred of everything that controls him and suppresses him and constrains him. How can such a symbol be made meaningful, be kept vital in a culture which by the mid or certainly by the later 18th century was becoming a culture that it was all about the rights of the self?
Well, as a matter of fact, the devil begins to fade. I mean, the power of this symbol in our culture, this is what you're arguing in your book. We're talking now about things like the rise of science, the rise of what we're like the fish in the sea, the secular society we inhabit.
The Augustinian devil fades.
Right.
That is, the devil as a symbol of the fractured and depraved self fades. He fades not only because pride becomes a virtue in the American pantheon. I believe Dr. Johnson looked across the ocean and referred to these Americans as lords of me. Me was the big word. I. Right. Tocqueville came here in the 1830s and had to invent a new word to describe this culture. The word was individualism. So in a culture like that, the devil was the odds were stacked against the devil. The other thing that the devil had to contend with in the 18th and certainly in the 19th century was, of course, the rise of science. I mean, how could you take seriously the idea of this spirit from what Cotton Mather called the invisible world, mm-hmm. this spirit that could invade the body, particularly the bodies of women and young girls, and lead them toward and into temptation? How could you take seriously this idea in an age of empirical science?
What you were speaking about, Andy, is what the historians and you literary people call the age of reason. In other words, we begin to step back from that supernatural idea of Satan as a force in our lives.
From all supernatural ideas, indeed. People, for instance, who had been judged to have been possessed by spirits, right, were now judged to be ill. That modern idea of mental illness comes into play in the 18th century.
So the age of therapy is nothing new.
Not at all. Old in this country.
Let's move forward in our American culture, this assessment that you are making of the way Americans understand and talk to one another about evil. Let's move into the 19th century. One of the great examples that you write about is the enormity of slavery as a manifestation of evil in our culture. Right. Speak to me about this for a few minutes.
Well, we talk about the division of the country, the sectional division of the country in the years leading up to the Civil War, and I think one of the manifestations of that is that both sides discovered the devil in the other. That is, for the forces of the anti-slavery movement, the devil became these cruel, barbarous, savage slave masters, mm-hmm. south of the Mason-Dixon line.
Simon Legree.
Exactly, Simon Legree and many other figures like Simon Legree. For the Southerner, the devil became this rapacious, business-minded, greedy Yankee who would trample on the property rights of good white American males in order to increase their own capital acquisition.
And overarching these two conceptions of monster on one side, monster on the other, we have the noble, brooding, and enduring presence of President Lincoln.
Indeed.
Who unpack this for me. It's
well,
a very big order.
I think there's a moment in my book where I refer to Lincoln as the greatest Augustinian in our history. Because it seems to me what Lincoln tried to do is he tried to argue against and steer between these two demonizations that is the North of the South and the South of the North. He never, even in his greatest speeches at Gettysburg, the second inaugural, he never spoke of the Confederate South as the fell and mighty, demonic, satanic enemy. It was not part of his vocabulary. And yet he had a very vivid conception of evil. He described slavery as a great evil. He talked about his hatred for slavery. And the reason he could reconcile this hatred of the evil of slavery with his refusal to use a demonic vocabulary is because he understood evil in the way that Augustine did. Mm-hmm. Evil was the failure to extend the human compassion and the rights of the individual to these disfranchised black people.
All right, now if Lincoln embodies our political sense, or for you, the purposes of your book, a political example of coming to terms with the problem of evil in American culture, I want you, Andy Del Banco, to give me a quick sense of our literary expressions. You write, for example, about Nathaniel Hawthorne. You write about Herman Melville. I believe you say that Melville's Moby Dick is the great American novel. I take it has something to do with this question of evil.
It does indeed. For me, the portrait of Ahab and his quest of revenge after the white whale is the great narrative, the great dramatization of this impulse that Melville saw deep in the American psyche, and indeed in the human psyche, to compensate for the feeling of pain and suffering and the diminution of the self. Ahab, after all, has been mangled and crippled by his encounter with this whale.
He's very proud at the same time.
He's proud, and he's after a psychic compensation by pinning the woes of the world on that creature.
Mm-hmm.
Melville says at one point that he found in Moby Dick something in which evil could be made practically assailable. That is, all the evils of the world were concentrated for Ahab into that unreadable, illegible brow of that great white whale. Right. And the remarkable thing and the terrifying thing about that book is how adept Ahab is, how brilliant he is at convincing the members of the crew of the Pequod to join him in the quest, to feel the same way. They, after all, most of them have never caught sight of this whale. Some of them haven't even heard of him. But but before long, they're on the quest with him, because he makes them feel that by conquering this external force, by killing this external force, they can save themselves from their own suffering.
Andy DelBanco, we're talking about your book, The Death of Satan, How Americans Have Lost the Sense of Evil. Let's again move forward in time in American cultural history. You write about what you call the age of blame, the culture of the age of irony, and the word responsibility hovers above these chapters. Let's unpack those issues.
Well, I have a chapter called The Age of Blame, which very roughly refers to the years, so say, from about the 1880s into the 1920s. In some ways, it leaks forward into our own time. And this, of course, is a period of enormous immigration in which the complexion, literally and figuratively, of American culture is changing, in which all the bewilderments that accompany industrialization and urbanization are moving fast and furious. And I think there's a way in which Americans, again, like Ahab, compensated, dealt with their sense of dislocation, with their sense of impotence, with the trauma, even the trauma of the Civil War itself and the ocean of death that it had opened up to them, by fixing the finger of blame on this swarthy, alien, strange, threatening other that seemed everywhere.
We're talking about the Irish. We're talking just that wave of people.
The Irish come first, later the Jews and Italians, and all along blacks. I mean, the 1880s, 1890s, early years of the 20th century were very dark years for African Americans because they were such a convenient and such a helpless target.
What about this term, help me with it, the culture, the age of irony? How is it exactly that you use this word? I remember reading that one of our columnist Roger Rosenblatt declared the death of irony 10 or 15 years ago. What do you mean by that?
Well, Roger, I think has in mind the notion that we've lost the capacity for self-criticism. Uh-huh. Maybe we have. But my sense of what irony is about is that early irony, of course, has always been with us. There are ironic writers all along.
But Satan himself is one of the great ironists, isn't
well,
he?
Well, exactly, because what is irony is the impulse to turn the world upside down.
Right.
To take the conventions and assumptions and premises about which on which we organize our lives, to take the notion of what is normal, or what is good, or what is beautiful, and invert it, question it, hold it up to a different light, look at it from a different perspective.
Oh, now wait, isn't that what you professors get paid to do?
It is indeed, and I think that a degree of irony is crucially important for the psychic and indeed the moral health of any culture.
Well, what does it have to do with evil?
Well, what it has to do with evil, I think, in an historical sense, is that in the 20th century, the revulsion with where the age of blame had led became so overwhelming. I mean, the revulsion, for instance, against the First World War, in which many of our intellectuals and politicians construed the world as divided between the good and the bad, between the us and the them. The revulsion against this was so great that irony began to develop with an intensity that it had never done before. It went into a kind of quiescence or dormancy, I think, in the 1930s and 1940s, when we had once again a confrontation with a real evil about which it was very difficult to be ironic. But it came back again with a vengeance in the beginning in the 50s and in the 60s. I think it was given a great boost by the war in Vietnam. And we now live, I think, in a culture where no propositions tend to be taken seriously, no claims to normalcy, as President Harding used to refer to it, or the good are taken seriously. Everything is a target for inversion.
Now, is this more or less the sort of concept that is governing our American popular sense of evil in the 1990s?
Well, this takes us back to what we spoke about at the beginning. It seems to me there are great sectors of this culture which have become saturated with irony, so that the image of the devil, as I mentioned before, would be Jerry Lewis prancing around on the stage in New York with a pair of artificial horns. Mm-hmm. The devil is a joke. Everything right. is a joke. For yeah. David Letterman, everything is a joke. For Spy magazine and increasingly for mainstream magazines, everything is a joke. And there is a reaction setting in against this sensibility. Clearly, the great many Americans whom intellectuals tend to denigrate as fundamentalists or Christian right uh-huh. are reacting with great discomfort against this attitude.
Well, now, is there a way quickly, Andy DelBanco, to generalize about the way the churches in America have responded to your conceptions of evil? Certainly, they're aware of it.
Well, I think the church is, you know, the trouble that the church is, like all other institutions that are, all institutions I think are fundamentally conservative, churches, universities, schools, are trying to find ways to bring the old moral language of good and evil back to vitality, back to life. And mm-hmm. some do well at it, and some do less well. But the problem is we can't go backwards. This is not about theological nostalgia. This is not about saying, let's get back the old Calvinistic worldview, right. or let's get back the old view that the two-parent nuclear family is the standard of all normalcy, or that white folks, God forbid, are normal and black folks are abnormal. Right. That's not what this is about, but we have to find ways to create at least some kind of moral geography. Otherwise, I fear that we will move first toward chaos and then toward reaction.
We hear a lot of talk these days, Andy DelBanco, about families and family values, that families are being attacked. We have politicians who are attacking popular culture and actually using words like evil and the devil when they describe our popular phenomena, music, television, stage screen, whatever. Anything to that? I mean, how does that enter into the conversation in your book?
Well, it's not something I address directly. I think, you know, we get tangled up with issues of free speech and individual expression when we start talking about the pernicious influence of the negative images. But I think it's tied up with this notion of evil as privation. I think there's a great appetite for images to which we can aspire, mm-hmm. images that make us feel that there are better possibilities out there.
Well, America loves a happy ending. I mean, that is characteristic of our literature, our popular culture.
It has been, though now the happy ending tends to be parodic, right? The Hollywood happy ending now, the TV happy ending, tends to be, it's hard for us to take it seriously.
Right.
We feel corny if we're into happy endings.
Andy, how does all of this come to you personally? You are a scholar of American literature. You do literary history. You teach at Columbia University. I take that there, at some level, there is a personal dimension working in your account of how Americans have lost the sense of evil.
Well, I think we all have to recognize the personal roots of what we do. And for me, as a child of German Jewish parents who, because of their combination of foresight and good luck, were able to escape the greatest horrors of the Holocaust, but who nevertheless experienced the rise of Hitler and left their native country. I've all my life been very conscious of this phenomenon. I've all my life been obsessed with the question of how a civil culture, a literate culture, a scientifically sophisticated culture could have fallen into such barbarism. And also with the question of where you draw the line between appeasement, explanation, that liberal impulse to look at the doer of ill, the criminal, with the eye of the therapist, with the eye of understanding. I mean, where do you draw the line between that? I mean, you know, there have been books written about explaining Hitler because he was badly abused as a child or deprived of parental love as a child.
Oh, that's the premise of a lot of our detective fiction and novels, The Silence of the Lambs. And
exactly.
Well, now, wait, that may be an exception. Dr. Hannibal Lecter says, wait, I wasn't abused. I'm just bad.
Well, Dr. Lecter knows that he's living in a therapeutic culture, and
right.
he looks in that novel at the young female FBI agent, and he challenges her and says, look, you don't dare to call me evil. Uh-huh. You've got me in behavioral costume. You're explaining me, but you're not confronting me. You're not recognizing me for what I am. Where do you draw that line? It's a terribly difficult question for liberal secular culture.
Andy, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Your book is The Death of Satan, How Americans Have Lost the Sense of Evil. Does the devil have a future in American culture? Are we back to that twofold split, that sense of evil outside, the monster, the thing that we characterize as the devil and evil, or do we turn inward here?
I'm sure the devil has a future. Let me read you perhaps a few sentences from the end of the book. Satan, always receding and always sought after, has had two very different meanings in our history. Sometimes he's been used for the purpose of construing the other as a monster, and sometimes he's been a symbol of our own deficient love, our potential for envy and rancor toward creation. Since the experience of evil will never go away, one or the other of these ways of coping with it, sooner or later, always comes back. For me, the great question is whether we will fall into the trap of construing evil as the outsider, whether we'll find a substitute for that lost Soviet enemy, or whether we will come to terms with the fact that we're all capable of ignoring the humanity of others.
Andrew Del Banco is the author of The Death of Satan, How Americans Have Lost the Sense of Evil. The Death of Satan is available from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Andrew Del Banco is a professor of English and American Literature at Columbia University in New York. He's also the author of The Puritan Ordeal, available from Harvard University Press, and writes frequently for many national journals and newspapers. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio cassette of this program. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was Andrew Del Banco of Columbia University. Audio cassettes are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 787. That's $10, program number 787. The address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, novelist Jim Grimsley. He'll be here to read from and talk about two of his books, Winter Birds and Dream Boy. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. The Death of Satan, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation with literary scholar and social commentator Andrew Del Banco. He'll be here to talk about his new book, The Death of Satan, How Americans Have Lost the Sense of Evil. Del Banco's new book traces the history of an American paradox, The repertoire of evil has never been richer than it is today. Yet our grasp on the reality of evil is weak, our responses to it flustered. How has this crisis of incompetence come about? The Death of Satan, Americans and the Sense of Evil, this week on Soundings.